A bunch of delinquents today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump calls our NATO allies delinquent on military spending.
He is looking at NATO as a dollar machine in which the question is not what does NATO do together in order to deal with the security challenges that we face, but who's paying what for what's going on.
Also, asylum seekers have to deal with a lot of red tape and gridlock on the border. So some of them are taking matters into their own hands with a makeshift solution.
It's completely unsanctioned, unofficial. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials will not comment.
Plus, a battle royal on the soccer field between Belgium and France had me thinking of fries. Those stories and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to be back with you, everyone. You know, there are many ways you could open a meeting between allies. I'm pretty sure, though, that no one would recommend starting by berating those allies. And yet, that's what President Trump did today, speaking at a breakfast gathering at the start of the NATO summit in Brussels. Trump told the gathering that America's NATO allies aren't paying enough for their own defense.
Many countries owe us a tremendous amount of money from many years back, where they're delinquent. As far as I'm concerned, because the United States has had to pay for them.
In the past, NATO allies have committed to spending at least 2% of their gross domestic product on defense, and several member states have been moving to meet that target over a number of years. But as of right now, most of NATO's 29 members have not done so. Today, Trump demanded that all members hit that 2% level immediately, and then suggested doubling that target to 4%. In the end, the summit produced a statement in which everyone committed to, quote, improving the balance of sharing the costs and responsibilities of alliance membership, end quote. And NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg tried to put out the fire that Trump ignited.
In the history of NATO, we have had many disagreements, and we have been able to overcome them again and again. Because at the end of the day, we all agree that North America and Europe are safer together.
Earlier today, we spoke with Ivo Dalder. He's president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. But before that, he was U.S. ambassador to NATO. I asked him what he makes of today's events.
Well, I think we're hearing two different things, and that's kind of interesting. At the Trump level, we're hearing the kind of rhetoric that we've frankly been hearing for the last 2 years, which is that NATO may not be that important to America. It's certainly less important to America than it is to Europe, and that Europeans need to do more on defense. But the second thing that's happening, and that's also important, is that NATO actually has agreed, including President Trump, to a whole series of measures to continue to increase defense spending and, importantly, to bolster deterrence in Eastern Europe in order to strengthen the capacity of the alliance to respond to the challenge of Russia. And that, too, is a reality that could have been much worse. There is an agreement in NATO to move forward, and that's a good thing.
So with these nations bumping up their defense spending, do you think that's in reaction to Trump's argument that we've heard so much of, that some of Europe's NATO members are free riders and not paying their fair share?
Well, I think it's really due to three reasons. First and foremost, it's due to the fact that Russia is reemerging as a security threat to Europe. And indeed, European defense spending has been going up since 2014 for 4 years in a row. Secondly, the European economies have rebounded. There is now more room for increasing defense spending. And then third, I think President Trump in his own particular style has made clear that this is an issue that is important to him, and allies are trying to find ways to meet him at least halfway. If that means increasing defense spending that at the same time helps him deal with the Russian threat, so much the better.
I guess what I'm asking is, have Trump's complaints worked on the European NATO allies?
They have worked for now.
How worried are you that at the end of the summit or weeks after the summit, Trump may actually pull the U.S. out of NATO? And what do you think that would do to the world order?
I'm not yet worried about this. I think it was important for the president to sign on to the NATO communique that he did earlier today. I don't think NATO is about to see the United States leave. If, of course, the United States were to leave NATO, that would fundamentally undermine the alliance. The alliance may be formally an organization of 29 independent states in which everyone has the same vote. But in reality, the United States has been and is today and continues to be the leader militarily, politically, in every other way.
So history shows us that NATO gained increased relevance in the 50s with Soviet expansionism. So as to Trump's repeated claim that the U.S. carries an unfair burden in NATO, we know that's not true. The U.S. carries 22%. Do you ever read between the lines and think that his using this excuse is just a chance to let Putin and Russia be more expansionist?
Well, clearly, the more Europe is divided, the more NATO is divided, the more the West is divided, the more Putin benefits. Because after all, the Soviet aim during the Cold War and Putin's aim in the last decade or more has been to divide Europe, to divide NATO, to divide the West. And so in that sense, the more the United States is cause of division, the more Russia stands to gain.
So what explanation can you come up with to help us understand why Trump would do that?
I think he has a view of NATO that doesn't look in that larger strategic picture. He is looking at NATO as a dollar machine in which the question is not what does NATO do together in order to deal with the security challenges that we face, but who is paying what for what's going on. And not looking at this as a strategic alliance that exists first and foremost to provide global security in the face of real challenges, of which Russia today is one and perhaps the major one.
So it was about a year ago that we spoke with you, Ambassador Dalder, just ahead of Trump's first meeting with NATO. Obviously, a lot's changed since then. But what sticks out to you in the past 12 months or so when it comes to Trump's stance towards NATO allies?
That nothing has changed. And the reality is that the kind of conversation we had a year ago was about the fact that President Trump did not seem to value NATO as an institution that adds to American security and brings partners and allies together with the United States to deal with common threats. The way he looks at NATO is in terms of how many dollars are being spent on defense, not on the strength that comes with having strong allies on our side. So in that sense, President Trump today is the same as he was when he became president, and frankly, has a similar view to NATO and allies and their role in the world that he's had for the last 30 years. He looks at them as people who can either contribute to America or detract from American interests, and he increasingly sees them, whether it's on trade or defense, as detracting.
Ivo Dalder, he's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Thank you.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
In addition to berating NATO allies for their lack of military spending today, President Trump also lashed out at Germany for being, quote, a captive to Russia. Trump specifically criticized Germany for being too dependent on Russian supplies of oil and gas. The specific numbers Trump cited were incorrect, but there's a kernel of truth in the larger criticism. In fact, today's statement from the NATO summit said it was essential the allies not be vulnerable to energy being used as a coercive tool. Dirk Assendorf is a science journalist based in Bremen in Germany. Tell us, first of all, how much of its energy does Germany get from Russia?
It's about 20% of its total primary energy consumption that comes from Russia.
Right, 20%. And what's been the trend? Is that proportion increasing or decreasing, and how quickly?
It's more or less stable over many years. Expectation is that over time it might eventually decrease because, you know, of German Energiewende, we try and have more and more renewable energy in our system.
And that 20% dependency on Russia, has Russia ever threatened to cut supply to influence like a policy decision in Germany?
Yeah, it's interesting. This never happened. Gas supply from Russia started already in 1973. So this is during in the mid of Cold War. This is 45 years now. And delivery has always been stable. There was never any political pressure using these gas imports in Germany. And it was also a good deal for both sides because Germany was not only importing gas, it was also exporting the pipelines and the infrastructure for gas extraction and production.
Russia has used its energy influence elsewhere though, right?
Certainly so, especially like last time we remember was in 2015 when Russia stopped natural gas supplies to Ukraine altogether. this was finally negotiated and gas delivery started again. Then also in the 1990s, when the Baltic states tried to become independent from the Soviet Union, Russia used gas supply as a political means, but not successfully, though.
So does the dependence on Russian energy make Germans anxious? I mean, Donald Trump seemed to suggest that this is a very worrying trend.
No, actually, not at all, because we are very much used to that. And then if you look at dependency, actually, the dependency the other way around is much higher. Russia does not play a major role for German foreign trade. It only makes up 2-3%. But Germany has a share of 9% of Russian foreign trade. So if this kind of trade would stop, it would hurt Russia much more than it would hurt Germany.
So much of the world may be surprised to see Trump critiquing Germany and other countries for dependence on Russia for energy, but he's also kind of side-handedly critiquing Russia and Putin for aggressively flexing their energy muscle in NATO countries. Should that be a surprise to us?
It should, because they don't. Russia actually lives on the money it makes by exporting its energy supplies.
So what you're basically saying is that Donald Trump is making a fuss where there really isn't one.
I would say so, yes. And I suppose this is for domestic political reasons, because in Europe, everyone knows. And if Trump says something like that in Europe, I think it's meant to be broadcasted in the U.S. and have impact there.
German science journalist Dirk Asendorf, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There was a different sort of NATO battle going on yesterday on the soccer field, France versus Belgium at the World Cup. I happened to be on vacation in France as the men in blue scored their way through the round of 16 and the quarterfinals. Sadly, kickoff for the France-Belgium semifinal started precisely when I got on my Air France flight yesterday. And this shocked me. Air France was not streaming the match on board. Instead, the pilot from the cockpit updated the soccer lovers in the cabin.
All soccer lovers, France by 1 point.
Not much reaction in the plane. I think it was mostly Americans coming back stateside. Anyway, at the end of 90-plus minutes of play, France still had just that one goal the pilot told us about, and Belgium, zero.
Qu'est-ce qui t'arrive? Tu as pleuré.
France versus Belgium, a country known for steak and fries versus one known for mussels and fries. Steak frites versus moule frites. Looks like steak won this time. France and Belgium, though, will always have fried potatoes in common. So here's an appropriate tune for that, a song I happened to catch on French radio last week. Goes back to 1996 from singer Valérie Lemercier. Goûte mes frites. Taste my fries.
Goûte mes frites. T'as vu ce veau? Qu'est-ce qui t'a pris? Avec Véro, on te l'a. De Pépito, tu t'es retrouvé sur son frigo. Oublie le vide, oublie ce type. Viens, goûte mes frites. T'étais si drôle, t'en souviens-tu? Avant qu'il te colle. Moi j'en ai marre de devoir souffrir.
Nope, never can have too many fries. That tune culled from the French jukebox from singer Valérie Lemercier. You're with the world.
Oublie ce type. Viens. Goûte mes frites.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, is getting ready for his confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill. One subject he can expect to be asked about a lot is abortion and whether he'd vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. So it's a good time, perhaps, to ask, what's it like in a country where abortion is illegal? The answer, of course, depends on what country you're talking about. The world's Rupa Shenoy decided to ask the question of the small South American country of Paraguay. She was there for our Across Women's Lives project, and she found the answer led back to a longtime dictator who was backed by the U.S. And I should warn you, this story includes some details that may not be appropriate for everyone.
3 years ago, Paraguay made one of its rare appearances in international news for a horrible reason. A 10-year-old girl called Mayumbu had been raped by her stepfather, and despite pressure from the United Nations and Amnesty International, the Paraguayan government forced the girl to give birth because abortion is illegal in the country. Illegal abortions are one of the leading causes of death among Paraguayan women. This March, it happened again, but this time, the 14-year-old girl who'd been raped died during childbirth. Paraguayans have responded with protests like this one on a Saturday morning in Asunción. Shop clerks lean out of doors to watch as hundreds of children march on a downtown street carrying signs that say, "My body, my territory," and "Girls aren't mothers." Margarita Troche is here with her children.
We're here today for the children who are abused in Paraguay.
Two girls younger than 14 give birth every day in Paraguay, according to UNICEF. Troche says things like that happen in part because girls don't know they have a right to say no, because there's no sex education in schools.
Minors don't have that understanding, so they fall prey to these situations that we know are, in fact, sexual abuse.
It's impossible to separate issues like abortion, child sexual abuse, and a lack of sex ed in Paraguay because they're all linked. And Paraguayan women have a hard time talking about any of those issues without also mentioning a man who still symbolizes a culture of oppression and machismo, Alfredo Stroessner, the longest-serving dictator in South American history from 1954 to 1989.
En esa época, Paraguay no se podía sacar la verdad.
In those times in Paraguay, you couldn't speak the truth.
Just a few blocks away from the march, Martin Ibarola is caretaker at one of the last standing reminders of Stroessner's regime, a rundown one-story jail once used to hold his political prisoners. He speaks through a tube in his neck because of an illness. And he says Stroessner was brutal. Protests were banned. The press was restricted. Elections were orchestrated. Gay men were persecuted. In the museum, framed documents show Paraguay's role in Operation Condor, an agreement among six South American dictators to disappear their political enemies so dissidents couldn't escape to neighboring countries. The U.S. helped train soldiers in torture in the name of stopping the spread of communism.
They used the communism with the help of the United States, not only Paraguay, but all the South American countries.
They used the idea of communism to get help from the U.S., not just Paraguay. All of South America.
There was special torture for women. Out back are small jail cells where Ibarola says female prisoners were raped. Ibarola says a few have come back and talked to him. One was named Teresita.
Teresita me cuenta de la tortura, pero nunca yo como ella y mujer preguntales.
Teresita would tell me about the torture, but I never ask women about being raped. I asked the men who did their military service here if they remember her, and three of them said, "Yes, I knew her. She was too pretty." That tells you everything. They tell me that when shift change would happen, the officer in charge would start his shift by raping Teresita.
The dictatorship ended in 1989, and Stroessner died a decade ago. Some things have improved. For example, almost a third of Paraguayan women work as maids, and under Stroessner, they had no set wage, working hours, or age limits. Now it's law that they earn at least 60% of minimum wage. So there's a ways to go. Stroessner's political party, the Colorado Party, remains in power today, and across the street from the museum memorializing his atrocities— The walls of buildings are covered with fresh graffiti calling for legal abortion and accusing the state of oppressing women.
Hola. Hola. Permiso. Hola.
Far down the street in Paraguay's Congress, women still feel like they're fighting a male-dominated culture that Stroessner enforced. Rocio Casco was a university student activist when the dictatorship ended. Now she's one of a few female lawmakers. As she walks into the auditorium where they debate bills, she's surrounded by men in black suits and a few women in skirts and really high heels. Casco, in contrast, wears a red plaid shirt, jeans, and sneakers. Recently, she introduced a bill that would increase penalties for targeted violence against women from fines to years in prison. There was a line in the legislation that said women in Paraguay face attacks when they don't fit gender stereotypes. So when they're not, for example, submissive or heterosexual. Opponents latched on to one word, gender. It's not used much in conservative traditional Paraguay.
Luchamos mucho. Entonces, era así una confrontación casi intergaláctica.
We fought a lot. It was almost an intergalactic confrontation because for opponents, the word gender was the end of the world. They argued that the law was a hallmark of a foreign ideology that would impose a new world order. The conspiracies were unbelievable over one word.
In the end, she had to take the word out to get the bill passed. Gasco doesn't think the law is as powerful as it could have been. I meet Sonia Bruque in a restaurant near Congress where all the politicians hang out. She helped create the country's Ministry of Women, which was a big deal in those first few years after the dictatorship ended, when Paraguay was building a democracy. But recently, she says, progress has slowed. Bruque thinks there's a powerful new conservative movement in Paraguay that's pushing back on women's rights, just like in the U.S. and Europe.
Hoy día hay mucho más resistencia a temas.
Today, there's a lot more resistance to topics that have to do with women's sexual health, women's work, gender relations. I think that there's been a regression in terms of support of these topics.
Bruque now leads a congressional committee on women. She wonders if her generation has become too complacent.
When I talk about changes, my daughter doesn't understand what I'm talking about. For her, this is awful. It could be better. But for me, this is a lot because I saw what came before.
Bruque says younger women who aren't marked by the Stroessner era demand high standards. They won't just settle for things being somewhat better than they were before. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Asuncion.
More from Paraguay tomorrow when Rupa brings us her next story. It's about singer Andrea Valobra. She was a rising pop star in Paraguay. Then in 2015, she came out with a controversial song about a woman who fears her abusive husband.
Some people say, oh my gosh, why are you doing this? All of us men are going to feel like so bad.
And her career tanked. Paraguay's Me Too moment, it's still a work in progress. We'll hear that story tomorrow on the show. I'm Marco Werman. Ice cream made in Philadelphia and sold in China as a luxury item.
We have a 16.5% butterfat recipe, which makes the product very rich and creamy. It has a very silky mouthfeel.
This ice cream maker says sales would be even sweeter without the tariffs. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The trade war rhetoric is flying fast and furious between Beijing and Washington now, and that worries American businesses that export products to China. This trade war is sure to cost them some sales. In Philadelphia, an ice cream maker has already gotten used to this. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
Michael Strange is the owner and president of Bassett's Ice Cream in Philadelphia.
The company was founded by my great-great-grandfather in 1861. That makes us the oldest ice cream brand in America.
I met with Strange at Philadelphia's Reading Terminal Market, a place to try cheesesteaks, hot dogs, or pastries. People line up at Bassett's counter to sample the premium ice cream, flavors like Irish coffee, moose tracks, and butterscotch vanilla.
The driver is the amount of butterfat in our product. We have a 16.5% butterfat recipe, which makes the product very rich and creamy. It has a very silky mouthfeel.
He's not exaggerating. I did some investigative research after. The ice cream is outstanding. You don't stay in business since the Civil War without knowing what you're doing. Still, when I first heard that this regional company with 30 employees was exporting ice cream to Asia, my first reaction was, what? How does it make economic sense to ship ice cream frozen halfway across the world?
And my standard reply is, it actually costs me more to ship our product to Chicago than to China.
Transporting by ocean container ship is cheaper than going by truck. Still, wouldn't it just be easier to send the recipe to Asia and churn it over there?
And not to say anything too negative, but they really don't know how to make ice cream the way we do here in the United States. So made in the USA is a very big part of our marketing in Asia. And if we made it there, we couldn't say made in the USA.
Strange began exporting to China a decade ago, then to South Korea in 2016. In just a year and a half, his Korean partner has opened 32 Bassett's ice cream cafes, surpassing Chinese sales. One reason for the explosive growth in South Korea? No tariffs. The U.S. and South Korea have a free trade agreement. But for a decade, every gallon of ice cream Strange has exported to China has been slapped with a 19% tax. His Chinese buyer has to pay that.
The tariffs really do add quite a bit to his costs. That said, he is marketing the product as a super premium ice cream, so he's really trying to reach middle income and higher income customers. And unlike a Ferrari or a Porsche, ice cream is affordable even to a middle income customer, even if it's expensive by ice cream standards.
Still, Strange says without those tariffs, he'd be selling a lot more scoops in China.
No doubt about it.
And make no mistake, this is far bigger than just selling a few extra ice cream cones.
How great for the city of Philadelphia to have a Philadelphia company out there in South Korea or in China.
Linda Conlin is president of the World Trade Center of Greater Philadelphia. Her job is to help local companies navigate international export markets. She points me to a federal government statistic. For every $1 million in exports, that supports nearly 6 American jobs. Conlin is a former official in the George W. Bush administration. When I asked her about tariffs and a potential trade war, she was careful with her words.
Our companies are concerned about tariffs and the repercussions of a potential trade war. At the same time, we acknowledge that trade does not take place on a level playing field.
Conlin echoes what many say about President Trump's trade policy. He's tapped into a real problem with China, but tariffs are the wrong solution. Still, Conlin says she's hopeful the current disruption taking place will, in the end, be better for local businesses.
Companies that export typically enjoy higher revenues. They weather recessions better than non-exporting companies. They have access to a richer pool of employees. They tend to innovate more.
We've also developed some flavors specifically for the Asia market, including a green tea or what we call it matcha ice cream.
Michael Strange says his green tea flavor has also become popular in the U.S. as well. Strange is interested in expanding to more international markets in Asia, South America, and the Middle East. He says he's lived with Chinese imposed tariffs for a decade. They don't keep him up at night, but the threat of more coming?
I am absolutely concerned about that. No doubt about it.
And lest you think this is a story about one man's concern, ice cream contributes $39 billion annually to the U.S. economy. For The World, Jason Margolis, Philadelphia.
For months now, thousands of migrants have been sleeping on the streets of Paris, among them hundreds of unaccompanied minors. And according to Human Rights Watch, that's partly because of a flawed process in France for assessing how old migrant children are. Michael Bohenek of Human Rights Watch says when children are able to access the French child welfare system, that makes certain benefits available to them.
So the immediate benefit is shelter, food, clothing, the ability eventually to get into school. That's the first thing on their mind. In the longer run, getting into the child protection system, depending on your age, it can get you a residence permit. It can even get you access to French nationality. Kids aren't actually focused on this. They don't really know about this, but that is the way the French law works. So both in the short term and in the very long term, it's critically important that people who actually are under 18 get the benefits of the child protection system.
Did you speak with any children, like actual minors, who were turned away?
We spoke with nearly 50 children, and then we also reviewed case files of another 35 or so. And we saw three or maybe even four major problems specific to Paris. The first problem we find is that a lot are turned away at the door by security guards. We heard from kids who told us that they walked up to the door and were told, "You don't look like a kid, go away."
Wow.
So that's obviously not in compliance with the French regulations. The second problem is that by law, there's supposed to be a thorough multidisciplinary interview because a lot of kids don't come with documents. Their age is supposed to be assessed by psychologists and other professionals. And the benefit of the doubt is supposed to be given if it's possible it could be a kid. For whatever reason, a lot of kids tell us that they only get 3, 4, 5 minute interviews with just a few questions. And in fact, I watched a kid at the end of May walk into the evaluation center at about 8:10 in the morning and walk out about 10 minutes later and told me that he got a rejection from the officials. That's problematic because it's not the full evaluation that's required under law. And it also doesn't provide a written decision, which children will need if they're going to get the decision reviewed by a judge.
I mean, short judicial interviews seem obviously not sufficient to determine this stuff. Are there arbitrary reasons why the kids get turned away?
Even when they get a full interview, we were seeing in case after case that there's a whole host of bizarre decisions that are made. A lot of the case files show that it's presumed that if you work during the journey, as many kids do around the world, then you must not be a child. Similarly, if you take the decision on your own to travel to Europe, again, as unaccompanied children do by definition, then you must not be a child. If the accounts that they give are too detailed, that's evidence that they must be mature and therefore an adult. And on the other hand, if they're imprecise, they must be lying. So again, a lot of these kinds of grounds appear designed to exclude people from recognition rather than giving the benefit of the doubt, and in particular, rather than acknowledging the reality that lots of unaccompanied kids are facing on these journeys.
Do you have any numbers on how many kids have been turned away because they're determined not to be minors?
We were trying to get these numbers from the local government, and that's really difficult to determine. Overall, we know that roughly half of the unaccompanied kids who show up in France are seeking recognition in Paris. We know that number is about 7,000, 6,000. And about 45% of those, at least in the last year, were getting these kinds of summary interviews. And most of those are rejected.
So if these minors are rejected, if they're turned away, does that mean they're automatically considered adults under the law? And what disadvantages does that bring them?
Sure. I mean, they're not eligible for any of the child protection services until they get reviewed by a judge. And interestingly, at this stage, at the judicial stage, a lot of them do eventually get recognized. But in the meantime, they fend for themselves. They sleep on the streets. They sleep in squats. They might be lucky enough to find a citizen volunteer who offers a couch for a few days. But they're really subject to whatever depredations exist on the streets, crime, potential trafficking. Certainly, it's not a healthy, safe situation for anybody to be in, much less a child.
Michael Bohanek is the author of the Human Rights Watch report, Like a Lottery, Arbitrary Treatment of Unaccompanied Migrant Children in Paris. Michael, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
People who come to this country to request asylum have to deal with bureaucracy on both sides of the border. This next story is about asylum seekers taking part of the process into their own hands, and it involves a notebook, a sort of informal ledger, if you will. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with Cindy Carcamo about this. Carcamo is with the Los Angeles Times, and she reported on the ad hoc effort playing out at the San Ysidro Port of Entry. That's between San Diego and Tijuana, Mexico. And it's always busy there.
You'll find at least 100 people in the mornings from everywhere, really, from around the world. Mostly they're Central American mothers with really small children. You also have people from Africa, from Haiti. I saw people from Russia. I mean, it really, Turkey, everywhere.
And where exactly does the notebook come in?
So the notebook is kind of, it looks like a ledger almost. It has this kind of checkered decoration on the cover. You have the names of nearly 2,000 asylum seekers in this notebook. Basically, people who are trying to go to the port of entry and to ask for asylum. Their names are written in blue ink. And what happens is that every morning, Mexican officials communicate with U.S. Customs and Border Protection there at the San Ysidro Port of Entry, and U.S. officials tell them how many people they're going to take in for that day. What the Mexican officials do is, and they give that information to the asylum seeker who's in charge of the notebook that day. And let's say it's 30 people, that asylum seeker, the bookkeeper, calls out 30 names from that notebook, whoever's next.
So this is both kind of a formal and informal thing. It's a notebook with a bunch of information that's being relayed by officials, but it's being held and passed along from one person seeking asylum to the next as they wait.
Yes, it's completely unsanctioned, unofficial. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials will not comment on the notebook. They've refused to comment on the notebook. Mexican officials, when I asked them, they told me that this notebook does not belong to them, that it belongs to the asylum seekers, and they just help facilitate the process.
What do we know about the history of the notebook?
You know, this notebook is a reaction to what's happening at the port of entry. So what's happened is for the last 2 years, U.S. Customs and Border Protection has been limiting the amount of people who can actually come in every day to ask for asylum. And before this whole notebook process came about, there was some kind of system and more coordination between the U.S. government and Mexican officials, where they had this kind of system where they would give out numbers. But they stopped that. And because of that, this notebook is a way to kind of keep order and to keep the names of people as they come from different parts of the world, right? So, you know, the first thing that you're told when you get to that plaza right there near the port of entry is you need to get your name on that notebook.
So that sounds like a fairly good way to order things. What's wrong with that process?
I spoke with some organizers on the ground, immigrant rights organizers, who said that it's illegal, in many ways because, you know, it's a conflict of interest because you have an asylum seeker who's in charge of the notebook. There's no oversight. He or she is not accountable to anyone. And there have been allegations of, you know, some of those asylum seekers who are in charge of the notebook, you know, bumping themselves to the top of the list to get themselves in first before other people who have come before him or her. So really, they're saying that this system, while it does inject, you know, some kind of order into the chaos, that it's really flawed. It's a flawed method of keeping count of who should be let in and who shouldn't.
Do asylum seekers, as they gather at the border, do they know that they don't have to be on this list, that they can actually, you know, bypass it and get across the border and through official channels?
Some might have a clue, and there have been cases of people skipping the list altogether and just going to give themselves up at the port of entry by themselves. And some of them have been successful and some of them have been turned away. The thing is that if you're unsuccessful and you're turned away, and let's say the notebook keeper finds out and the other people find out, they're going to get really upset with you. I mean, it's happened. So it's... You know, really, people are within their rights to go and seek asylum and skipping this, you know, notebook altogether, because a notebook is unsanctioned, it's unofficial, you know, it's not a government thing. But people are scared of what the repercussions are if they do, you know, try to kind of skip the line or skip the book. Those who know about it, some people have no idea.
That was Cindy Carcamo, an immigration reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She was speaking there with The World's Carol Hills. The Men's World Cup is in its final week in Russia. If you're a soccer fan, you already know the finalists. Overall, though, there have been roughly 60 matches over the past 4 weeks, played between teams from many different countries. Off the field, there are many more matches happening, thanks to Tinder, the dating app. Amy Ferris-Rotman of The Washington Post is in Moscow, where she's been covering this curious sidebar to the World Cup. So, Amy, tell us a bit more about these connections that are being made off the pitch.
Essentially, Moscow has received this enormous flux of foreigners, all sorts of men, mostly young men who have descended on the city. And Russian telecom operators reported that Tinder, during the first week of the World Cup, saw a surge by 11 times. And wow. There's lots and lots of couplings happening between Russians and foreigners. And I spoke to some as well.
Yeah. So what kind of things did you hear? Who's dating whom?
They tend to be young Russian women, and they're dating people from pretty much everywhere. All of the countries which are participating, the Latinos seem to be extremely popular. I've also met girls who've been dating Egyptians, Tunisians, Moroccans, Brazilians, and Mexicans. I mean, I think it's worth noting that Russia does not have a lot of foreigners in the country usually. So these people who have been arriving, these soccer fans, or as we call football, they're extremely exotic. fantastic. A couple of the people from the embassies have told me that they've been dealing with marriage requests. You know, bear in mind, the World Cup has only been going on for less than a month. So quite extraordinary romantic leaps that are going on. The ambassador to Tunisia notably said that his embassy is actually grappling to deal with the number of requests they're receiving.
No kidding. So language barriers, that's not an issue?
So a curious thing is happening with the languages here. English is not widely spoken in Russia, and a lot of the fans do have some level of English. And what I noticed is that some couples are communicating by Google Translate, which I know it doesn't sound very romantic, but actually I watch some of them do it. They speak into it in their language, and then a man or a woman's voice comes out in Russian. Everything from, do you want to go watch the football, to I really like you. And it seems to create no barriers.
It's interesting, though, that you said that a lot of the Russians were kind of interested in the exotic countries. It's almost like they got this chance to have some weird smorgasbord of love.
Absolutely. And there are comparisons being made in the Russian media and by the Russian government themselves to the 1957 Youth Festival, which was a very important turning point in Soviet history. It's when, after years of Stalinist repression, the Soviet Union opened up its doors and invited people from, I think, over 130 countries. So a lot more than what we're seeing right now. And then, as now, it was the countries such as African countries, Asian countries, particularly Latin American countries, that were of particular interest to Russians. I mean, they don't usually encounter people from these countries.
Amy Ferris-Rotman of The Washington Post speaking with us from Moscow. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
People from all over the world have gathered in Russia to enjoy the Men's World Cup. Among them, a group of activists who put together a social media campaign that grabbed our attention. They call it the Hidden Flag. Six activists, all representing their countries, wearing different colored soccer jerseys. When they pose for pictures standing in the correct order, the jerseys form the gay pride flag. Their photos have been widely shared online. Eloy Peruzan Jr. was one of the activists who traveled to Russia for this campaign. He spoke with us earlier from Amsterdam. How did this whole campaign start, and how did you get involved?
So it started about in May or June when the LGBT Federation from Spain, they wanted to deliver a campaign or a message now in the World Cup period, since this topic is a kind of an issue in Russia. From there, they started to recruiting the activists from Spain, that was the easiest one, from Netherlands, from Brazil, from Mexico, Argentina, and Colombia.
So you managed to get countries that represent all those colors in the spectrum, red and blue and so on.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So tell us about some of the pictures in which your group is photographed. And these pictures have been shared pretty widely over social media. What do we see in them?
What we're trying to do was basically put ourselves in order to form the rainbow flag in the public spaces, in the monuments, around some bars, in the train stations, since we are not allowed to speak up our nature in Russia. So we really wanted to make this silence statement to tell the Russian gay community that they can rely on us, that we are together, that we were there just to try to help and to raise this topic. We've been receiving messages on social media telling thank you for coming over and to raise this flag for us, since you cannot do that over here. I got very emotional with that, because if you see that you maybe can help someone that is struggling only for being gay, to be born that way, it's very nice. It's a very good feeling.
Yeah, so you must have had a photographer following you around. And when you find those moments where you're all lined up, it's pretty powerful. You see the rainbow flag with your various colored soccer jerseys. What kind of response did you get from Russians?
All of the messages that I got on my Instagram was just to say thank you. We are very grateful that you took a risk just to raise this topic. I saw, of course, in some articles or in social media, on Facebook, on Instagram, of course, there wasn't only positive feedback. Sometimes we had some negative feedback, but that's fine. I believe that every cause, a polemic cause, would have these kind of reactions. I would say that 90% of the feedback is positive.
And did you feel, Eloy, yourself, the risk while you were in Russia?
No, actually, no. When I was invited for the project, my mother and my partner, they got very like, are you crazy to go to Russia? You know, that you can be in jail, you can be violence over there. But I explained the project and then they find that's fine. And in Russia itself was very okay. No one knew what we were doing over there for our safety. People, they basically come over to take photos with us because they found that it was very nice and funny, six friends from different countries taking photos. The most tense moments, I would say, is when we stay right beside the police, because we never knew if they realized that you were forming a rainbow in order and everything, but no one realized over there. So it was very okay.
I mean, it strikes me that the real risk is the one that's lived by people who are openly gay in Russia. How did it feel for you once you left Russia, knowing that that hatred, that animosity towards the LGBTQ community still exists in Russia?
Yeah, that's very sad, actually. But I'm so happy that this project is getting so big. Today, I was reading an article on New York Times. They asked for the person from the government of Russia that created this law, what he thought about this.
You're talking about the anti-gay propaganda law.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so nice when it gets in everybody's faces to talk about that. For the Russian gay people, it's very hard because of the law, but it's a way to make a kind of pressure, I believe. Mm. And I really want to believe that.
Eloy Perezan Jr., thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And that's where we leave it for today. It's good to be back with you after some R&R. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.